From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talk with Senator Stabenow about why she opposes the confirmation of Betsy DeVos for U.S. Secretary of Education.
She's advocated for weaker public schools, lack of accountability for taxpayer money.
Then a chat with the head of Michigan's Department of Transportation and the state's role in developing driverless cars.
I think the future is Silicon Valley and Detroit.
The city manager of Everett defends Nestle's request to extract water for its Ice Mountain bottled water.
They pick on Nestle. They don't go after Dasani or Aquafina or Coca-Cola or Budweiser. They use way more water than Nestle Ice Mountain possibly could use.
And with the Detroit Auto Show underway, we decided to bring you a cocktail named after a classic 1916 Packard luxury car. All of that and a political roundup of the Michigan legislature. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we'll speak with Senator Debbie Stabenow on the latest in Washington. Plus, we'll find out just how much the northern Michigan town of Everett relies on Nestle Corporation for its revenue. But first, Michigan is competing with other states to become a leader in the nation when it comes to autonomous vehicles. Google is opening a development center in Novi. The University of Michigan has M-City, the Mobility Transformation Center. And the governor recently signed laws to make Michigan more friendly to the development of driverless cars. Kirk Steidel is the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, and he joins us now. In a piece in the Lansing Journal more than a year ago, you were saying you hope one of your legacies will be that Michigan is on the forefront of automated cars and interactive infrastructure. Where are we in comparison to places like Silicon Valley?
Well, I'd say we are clearly in the lead. Silicon Valley is, you know, if anybody was at the auto show, we had Automobility going on. We had tech companies there. And clearly, I think the future is Silicon Valley and Detroit. As far as I'm concerned, that's a great comparison, and I think we're on a path really to great things here.
Explain to us what the Department of Transportation's role is in helping companies develop autonomous vehicles.
So everybody thinks of MDOT as, you know, maybe the orange barrel guys in the summer, or the pothole guys, or, you know, the like. But actually, we do a lot more than that. Our mission is really about moving people and goods across the state, one for economic benefit, and two for quality of life. So if you take that broader perspective, we really are integrated with the Economic Growth Group within Michigan, within Governor Snyder's administration, to help companies grow. And it, as transportation and the automobile and that whole sector starts coming together, there's going to be an interface that's more than just the tire, where the tire meets the road. You know, in the future, there's, in fact, we saw it at the auto show. We see cars that have lots of intelligence on them, but also cars that are connected to each other and connected to the infrastructure. That's where the DOTs come in.
Right. You mentioned interactive infrastructure. What does that look like?
So it could be a variety of things. I mean, right now, you could get a variety of commercial software applications that bring you traffic information to your car. And maybe your car brings it to you. You know, there's Waze and there's Google. There's a whole bunch of those. But then there is further information that's doing the predictive analytics of where traffic's going to be, what the weather's going to look like. But beyond that, there's a safety component, which is really the driver for departments of transportation. It's how do we make each car know where each other one is. It's kind of situational awareness so that as cars driving on the road, it knows which cars are around it, and it knows what's ahead of it. The ideal place is where the traffic signal can send the signal of two cars that are approaching it at the same speed, but one has a red light and it's going to run the red light. It can advise the car with the green light that says, don't go through this intersection because you're going to get in an accident. That technology exists today, and it's got to be connected with the traffic signals and with the infrastructure at the same time.
My friend and NPR colleague Sonari Glinton talks about automated cars a lot, saying that this will decrease the number of traffic deaths. Do we have any real indication that that's going to be the case?
Yeah, we absolutely do. NHTSA did a study. In fact, the pilot for all of this was done in 2011 in Ann Arbor. It's what we called the safety pilot model deployment. We had 3,000 cars on the road that were talking to each other, and about 100 of those were really smart that could receive information and speak. And what that test proved was with the technology, we could reduce accidents and crashes by 80%. So if you just think of the 35,092 people that died on America's roads last year, and in Michigan that number was 1,054, if you can reduce 80% of those fatalities, that's, you know, in Michigan's case, 800 people that are alive today because of the technology.
Let's talk about money a little bit. Michigan drivers complain about the condition of the roads. I'm sure you're well aware of that. The increase in money for roads, including that recent fuel tax that just went into effect, still falls short of what Governor Snyder has told us we need to keep the roads and bridges in good condition. Why spend money on developing infrastructure on automated cars when the state's roads are not in the best shape?
So you're not going to flip this whole thing at one time, right? So as we do a major reconstruction, like this summer, we've got major reconstruction going on US 23 north of Ann Arbor, and it's going to have all the intelligence in it. While we rebuild it, we'll put the intelligence in it. So in that case, we'll be able to direct traffic onto what will be a shoulder lane for rush hour times and push them back out. That technology will be built in. So as we're reconstructing is when we're putting the technologies in place. If you look at it from a traffic signal perspective, we replace traffic signals across the state every year, and we have 3,000 traffic signals. So if every one of those starts to be upgraded, then you're on a path to where the whole infrastructure is ultimately smarter. It's the same thing with cars. And not every car on day one is going to flip and all of a sudden be smart. They're going to have to roll out together. So there's a progression that, you know, the very first cars and the very first signals are going to be lightly used, but you have to start somewhere. So it's a matter of building it in to what you're already doing and doing it smart instead of just saying, well, we're going to spend a bunch of money on instrumenting a whole bunch of roadways and there's only one car that drives down. That doesn't make a lot of sense. We have to do it strategically when we reconstruct and when it's most cost-effective to put it into place.
Tesla has had some mishaps with driverless cars. What are the big concerns as this transition is underway?
Well, I think you just hit the right term there. It was a transition. We're going to be, I think, in a probably a 20-year messy transition where we're going to have really intelligent cars that actually probably operate the best of any on the roadway, and then we're going to have a bunch of dumb cars with very inconsiderate and dumb drivers. That mix is going to be here for a while. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to have the ability to drive for a lot of years, but I think the technology advancements that are coming in cars are going to allow people to decide when they want that and when they don't. You know, in the morning, if people are coming in and stop and go traffic, you know, the ability for that car to keep its distance from the one in front of us will certainly reduce a lot of the fender benders that happen every morning during rush hour because people are not paying attention.
So we're involved in this transition. How will that look? Will we see Lyft and Uber using autonomous vehicles first, or maybe FedEx and UPS, or something else?
You know, that's the big question. But from where I sit in the technology that I see, we're going to see this in the rideshare program. So we're going to see it in Lyft. We're going to see it in the Ubers type. And just think of this scenario. So you're in some downtown geographical area because it's got to be an area where the manufacturer is very comfortable with the technology, very comfortable with the geometry of the roadways, and they know it. It's mapped really well. Let's say you walk out of whatever building and you want to go to another building that's a mile away, and you call a Lyft. And so you dial up on your app, and it gives you two options. The first option is an autonomous one. So they're going to send an autonomous one, and it costs you X number of dollars. Or the second option is, if you don't feel comfortable with an autonomous one, they'll send you a one with a driver. And the driver, that one will probably cost you more money. So then you will have the option. If you don't like the automation, you don't trust it, it's no problem. You just go with the one that has the driver. I suspect, and this is purely speculation, that the cost of the driverless one will be significantly cheaper, and that will help drive people, no pun intended, into that automated car to give it a try. So I think that's where it's going to start. It's going to start in those on-demand automated services that was part of the legislation that Governor Snyder signed this fall, which allowed for those kind of operations to happen on Michigan roadways, which that is the only one of its kind in the entire country.
Kirk Steidel is the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The North American International Auto Show opens its doors to the public this weekend, showing off all those nice new cars. Sounds like the perfect time for a celebratory drink.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
We're with Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and
you've got a cocktail for us in honor of the auto show.
That's right. Since the auto show opened this week, I wanted to find a cocktail that had an automotive connection. And I went all the way back to the Packard Twin Six automobile.
You went way back. I don't think there are any Packards on display.
No, probably not right now. But back when they were on display then, they were a sensation. This was the luxury touring automobile in 1916. And the crowds were such so overwhelming when they would put it on display that they sometimes had to call the police to come in and take control.
Crowd control. Well, what does this cocktail have to do with it?
Just like today, bartenders are always looking for names for cocktails. And because this car was so popular, they would have just picked this to name a cocktail after. There's actually another cocktail called the Twin Six. The one we have today is called the Packard Twins, and it's sort of like a Manhattan variant. So it's going to use 1.5 ounces of rye whiskey, and in honor of the Detroit Auto Show, I used a Detroit rye from Detroit City Distillery. And then it has 3/4 ounce of sherry. We don't use sherry in cocktails very much now, but historically it was very common. And so here it's kind of taking the place of a sweet vermouth in a Manhattan formula. We've got 1/4 ounce of maraschino liqueur, a couple dashes of Angostura bitters, a couple dashes of orange bitters, and then we stir it up.
So sherry instead of sweet vermouth, what difference does that make in the taste?
Sherry is a Spanish product, and it's a sort of oxidized, fortified wine. So it has a really nutty, kind of caramely character. This is a sweet style of sherry, so it's going to add some sweetness, just like a sweet vermouth would, but almost a savory quality that I really enjoy in cocktails, and that's becoming really trendy again today.
I know I've asked you this before, but how long do you stir a drink like this?
About 50 revolutions. So it takes, you know, a good amount of time. You want to make sure this is really nice and cold, really nice and diluted.
Okay, well, let me take a taste of the Packard Twins. Oh, it really is like a Manhattan. There's a little difference, a little variance, but it's delicious.
Yeah, I like it a lot, but definitely be warned. It packs a punch like that V12 engine that was in the Twin Six.
Well, thanks very much for sharing the Packard Twins with us.
Cheers.
After the break, pressure to close down Enbridge Line 5, which runs under the Straits of Mackinac, continues. We'll speak with a tribal leader in Wisconsin on a recent decision they made. Then we'll discuss the week in Lansing politics with our Friday roundtable. Plus, exciting change happening at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Enbridge Oil Pipeline Line 5 stretches from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario. It crosses the northern Wisconsin area into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and then under the Straits of Mackinac, which connects Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. The path of the 64-year-old pipeline also crosses the Bad River Reservation in northeastern Wisconsin. The Bad River Band Tribal Council has passed a resolution to not renew the easement for Line 5. And the council calls for the decommissioning and removal of the pipeline from the reservation. Robert Blanchard is chairman of the tribal council, and he joins us now. So what led to the council's decision here?
Well, as you said, the pipeline is 64 years old, and we have concerns with that because anytime you put metal underground and leave it there for 64 years, the chance of something happening is much greater as the years go by. And we have a lot at stake there, so we want to have it removed and taken out before something happened.
I read in an online article from Univision ABC News Fusion TV, it indicates Enbridge was surprised by your decision and indicated it had been working with the Bad River Band to maintain a safe pipeline, inspected every 5 years, thought they were in good faith negotiations with the council for renewal of the easement. What changed, if anything?
Well, the easement that we're talking about expired in 2013, and as you said, Enbridge claims they have been in negotiation with us since that time. Now, I've been chairman since November of 2015, and I have never been or sat into any negotiations with them regarding that issue. So I don't know where they're coming from with that.
Could you do me a favor? Could you describe the Bad River Reservation? Where is it, and what's the terrain like?
We're located in northern Wisconsin along the shore of Lake Superior. It's in Ashland County, Wisconsin. We're a reservation. We have about just over 124,000 acres within our boundaries. And we have the what we call the Bad River watershed, where the Bad River runs, and everything that runs into the Bad River runs into Lake Superior. So anything were to happen out there, we have a lot at stake. We have our hunting, we have our fishing, and our harvesting and collecting our medicine. that would be forever lost if we were to have an oil spill of any type up there.
Were you and council members affected by things like the Kalamazoo Enbridge oil spill and the concerns of other tribal groups, such as the ongoing protest by Native Americans to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline? Is there a larger awareness? Is that what led to this?
Well, I think, you know, the Dakota Access, is we are in support of that. However, we have not been out there actively engaged, and I think we had some members go out there, but we do support them and their efforts. And like I said, 2013 was when the agreement expired. So we thought, you know, now is the time to do the right thing for our members.
Without your approval for renewal of the easement, what are the options left to Enbridge? In addition to that, are there really any legal obligations for them to remove the pipeline?
Well, that's something we're still looking at. I'm not prepared to make a statement on that end of it yet, but when we do figure that out, we will put that out there.
I expect you're going to be getting a call from Enbridge before too long. Do you expect the Bad River Tribal Council to possibly resume negotiations about the easement, or is that talk or that chance for talk over?
Well, I do expect we will be getting a call. I cannot answer or comment on what the council will do, but in my mind, I wouldn't think so. That we passed the resolution, and it is what it is.
So what's next then? Do we know?
That, like I said before, we're still weighing our options.
That is Robert Blanchard. He is chairman of the Bad River Band Tribal Council in Wisconsin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The new Michigan legislature was in session this week. Here to talk about that are Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. He joins us via Skype. And Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. Ken, Senator Jack Brandenburg wants to eliminate the personal income tax. Plans to phase out the tax are also being talked about. That would create a pretty big hole in the state budget. What do you make of this idea?
Well, Republicans always want to talk about cutting taxes. The income tax contributes a total of $9 billion to the state. A big chunk of the school aid fund is funded by the income tax. The easy part is talking about tax cuts. The hard part is presenting the spending cuts that have to go along with it.
Vicki, shifting the tax burden from income tax to, say, a sales tax is seen as regressive because it hits low-income families disproportionately. The Democrats don't have enough votes to stop something like that. What can they do?
If there is a replacement for this money, you're talking about more than doubling the current sales tax. So you would have to put on the ballot a sales tax increase of an additional 6 to 7% to make up that money. And don't forget, this comes on the heels of a sweeping tax policy change in 2011-12, which eliminated an additional $1.8 billion in business taxes that were coming into the state. So we haven't made up for that yet. Combining that with cuts to revenue sharing, we've really put our local governments in a stranglehold, as well as our school districts.
It seems among some legislators, we're seeing starting to see a growing fatigue on trying to fix the ongoing problems for cities such as Flint and Detroit. How do lawmakers maintain their focus on these kind of long-term crises, especially when they involve cities that, well, they're mostly black and they're mostly poor? There are a lot of white legislators out there whose constituents don't understand why we're throwing money at Detroit. Ken, what do they do? How do you keep up doing what you need to do for these cities and keep your constituents happy, too?
There's probably some legislators, mostly on the Republican side, are hoping that if you kind of start ignoring issues in Flint or Detroit or other large urban areas, that maybe the public has forgotten about the water problem in Flint. But there's a huge risk in that. Legislators have made a commitment to solving the water problem in Flint, for example, because it was by and large created by malfeasance and misfeasance at the state level. And there was a special committee chaired by Senator Stamos last year that made a lot of recommendations related to Flint and statewide on water issues. And most of those have yet to be enacted. I think they're not going to be able to ignore these issues. They're going to have to continue to face up to them, and their feet's going to be held to the fire in a kind of a gubernatorial election campaign season. They're not going to be able to avoid these commitments.
Vicki, we do hear from legislators that Detroit's gotten enough. We hear from their constituents even more loudly, especially if you read the comments sections on news pieces like I do. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a bigger problem because it's not only the water problem in Flint. It's infrastructure in general across the state, whether it be what we see in roads and bridges or the underground pipelines that we don't see and the water mains that are cracking. In Macomb County right now, there's a huge sinkhole, which is an erosion problem that's happening that's swallowed up three homes already and is continuing to drag on the resources of Macomb County. The state has finally helped by calling a state of emergency to support Candace Miller, who is the new water resources commissioner in, or the drain commissioner in Macomb County, to try to fix these problems. The business leaders of Michigan have recently come out with a plan that calls for $4 billion annually in increased revenue to support infrastructure repair and maintenance. So it's an ongoing problem. It's a long-term problem. But I think there's another issue that we're ignoring, and that is term limits. So it's not just legislative fatigue. It's a short-term goal of each legislator who's only going to be in the House for a maximum of 6 years to try to get through their individual policies and make a name for themselves and rush through things whether they need to be done or not, and not slowly deliberating and taking a look at the long-term needs of the state of Michigan, which are much longer than 6 years. And right now, I just don't see that type A personality legislators, which was the one thing that struck me, were 110 type A personalities in the same room every day, really have the wherewithal, the expertise, the history of working together that is really needed to tackle these long-term issues and problems.
Well, speaking of coming together, the new Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, called on the legislature to work in a more bipartisan fashion and with more civility.
And I believe that over the next 2 years, the citizens of our state not only want to see more civility in our political process, I believe they are going to demand it.
Ken, with all those type A personalities in the legislature that Vicki just mentioned, and after elections like we saw in 2016, how do you find civility?
Well, I'm glad the incoming speaker talked about the need for it, particularly in contrast to sort of the vitriol and viciousness, partisan viciousness at a Washington level. I hope Lancey doesn't catch that disease. But this issue of civility and his desire for it's going to be severely tested in the months ahead. There'll be issues that are going to be controversial. People are going to feel passionate about them. I think the gubernatorial election season is going to have an impact on that. So I'm glad and happy that he mentioned that early on, but the civility between Republicans and Democrats will be sorely tested in the months ahead.
Speaker Tom Leonard and Democratic leader Sam Singh are different people than their predecessors. Vicki, how much does leadership matter in trying to find civility?
I think it matters a great deal. And I just want to point out for the public that is listening and is not in those chambers every day in, day out, working with legislators, I will tell you that most of them get along on a personal level very, very well. And it's only a few issues that tend to work out and be extremely contentious. And those are the ones that deal with prevailing wage, unemployment insurance, the real pocketbook issues that Democrats and Republicans see very differently. In the old days, and Ken will remember this before term limits, a lot of work used to be done in committees. And the legislators, because they had these long-term personal relationships, were able to relax and socialize and talk about these issues and then go back into committee and bring to bear some of their conversations and their personal relationships to really work out bills. Now there's a rush to just get them out of committee, not really listen to the minority voices that are on the committee, whether you're in the majority as I was in my first term or in the minority in my second and third term. There's this oppression of the minority where we're really not listening to those minority voices, the Democrats right now, and working out solutions inside of the committee process. The goal is, well, we'll just fix it on the floor once we get it there. And then debate is quite often just gaveled down and stifled, and amendments are just gaveled down. So civility on these hot button issues is going to be very, very difficult to work out unless there is agreement that the Republicans and Democrats will seriously work together and not craft the perfect bill for each side, but the best bill for the state of Michigan. And I think that the leadership, and I know Speaker Leonard, and I think he's got a very good heart. And I'm hoping that aside from that if they just temper their attitudes on these hot button issues, civility can return. I'm very optimistic about state government and always have been.
That's Vicki Barnett, an Oakland County Democrat and former legislator, and Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks, both of you, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Some changes are coming to the Detroit Institute of Arts Contemporary Collection. Well, at least the management of it. Laurie Ann Farrell has been appointed as the new curator of contemporary arts, and she'll be joined by two assistant curators, Taylor Renee Aldridge and Lucy Mensa, and they're both on the line with us now. I was reading in the Black Life Arts and Culture, Black magazine, that this is the first time in 15 years that there's been a complete staff of three. Lucy, what kind of possibilities does that open up?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. I am very excited. I am thrilled to be part of this pretty much new a movement by the museum, its initiative to strengthen its relationship with the African-American community in Detroit. And I think the museum is going to do a great job. It promises to bring in new art. It promises to deliver exciting exhibitions. And it should be an interesting ride.
Taylor, you're already in Detroit. Are you Detroit native?
I am a Detroit native, yes. I left in 2007 when I finished up high school and left for undergrad. And then I came back in 2014 and have been working pretty closely with the arts community here. But I think in regards to your question about this new department, there's a lot of excitement here. But the fact that there hasn't been a relatively large contemporary art department for some time has allowed for some excitement to bubble up in the museum. And I think all three of us are really good at working collaboratively.
I want to ask you guys, I'm going to bring up the topic of race because each of you is an African-American and Detroit is predominantly African-American. And the collection it sometimes does reflect that, but often doesn't. And I just want to get your views on how the collection might actually serve the people in a city that aren't often served as well as they should be?
I'll answer the question first. Well, what motivated me to accept the position was that the DIA does have an extensive African-American art collection. It has more than 600-plus art objects on site. And I think what the museum is going to do is to utilize that extensive collection. And, I mean, we have everything there from Benny Andrews' work to Bob Thompson to Jacob Lawrence, Ramari Bearden, Glenn Ligon. The museum just acquired a David Hammond's piece, Bird. So I think what the museum has to do, and it will do, is to just let the Metro Detroit community know that this is here. And I think when
reach out to them to do that? How do you, to imply that DIA hasn't been serving the Black population in Detroit. I'm just saying the Black population in Detroit hasn't always been served well by the community. So I want to clear that up. So how do you reach out to them? How do you encourage them to find these wonderful works of art?
I think to get more African-American visitors into the museum, I think what the museum will do is to focus on programming. There's the education department will take that up, as well as creating exhibits and collaborating with other museums to bring exhibits that speak to the community. I think that will be a good first step.
So, Taylor, what speaks to the community?
I think Lucy's comments were spot on. But in addition to building up the African-American collection, which Valerie Mercer has done for about 15 years and has done it really well, I think the museum, particularly the community engagement departments, the programming departments, will continue to create opportunities for dialogue to happen with community members inside and outside of the institution. I think Salvador has begun doing this by stepping outside of the museum and going into various community spaces and just holding court with community members. I think our department is definitely looking forward to following suit, creating spaces for incubation for emerging artists in Detroit to come and practice and learn within the institution. I think it's definitely going to take some time, going to take some research, and just building on the existing partnerships and relationships that the museum has already put into place.
We've been speaking with Taylor Renee Aldridge and Lucy Mensa. They are the two new assistant curators in Detroit Institute of Arts Contemporary Collection. I'm looking forward to what you guys do in the next couple of years. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Up next, Michigan senior U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow talks about her concerns about repealing the nation's health care system without a clear replacement plan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Republicans in Congress are working quickly to set the stage to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare. The Senate took the lead in the effort. Joining us now is Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. President-elect Trump wants repeal and replace. What replacement is being proposed by your Republican colleagues?
Well, Lester, the fact is that they've not proposed anything at this point, and that's why this is so irresponsible. You know, every one of us is affected by health insurance reform because there are a whole range of patient protections that were put in for people who have insurance through their employer, making sure that insurance companies can't drop you if you get sick, if you've been paying premiums, making sure they can't block you from getting insurance by having a pre-existing condition, children up to age 26 on your policy, but a whole range of other things as well. Insurance companies in the past could cap how much they would spend on your cancer treatments, even if the doctor said you needed more treatments. Mental health parity, where you can't be discriminated against if it's mental health or substance abuse treatment. So a whole range of things go away for everybody under the repeal they're talking about, in addition to over 2 million people in Michigan losing their health care and weakening Medicare, raising the cost of prescription drugs under Medicare, and taking away a whole range of important services under Medicaid, including seniors and nursing homes. So this is irresponsible top to bottom, and in my perspective, they should put aside this whole idea of unraveling the whole system and instead work with us to make healthcare more affordable and make it better, because there's still work to do.
Polling shows a large majority of Americans say if you do repeal it, they want the Affordable Care Act replaced somehow. And I'm wondering what the Republicans are thinking when they see polls like that.
You know, I have no idea. I've seen nothing comprehensive. I've seen them talk about bits and pieces, but comprehensive health care is complicated to put together in that you need to look at everything. You need to look at how we make sure we don't have a rush of people using emergency rooms again, which is the most expensive way to get treated for medical care. For normal kinds of things, it could be done at the doctor. We've got to make sure that we don't see insurance companies again being able to take your premium money but then not cover you when you get sick. I've seen nothing that addresses those things, and we'll have to wait and find out.
There were two major concerns about the ACA. One was small businesses who weren't eligible for subsidies were seeing their premiums go way, way up and not always able to get the coverage that they needed. And the other complaint was that people didn't like the idea of using their taxpayer money to subsidize these premiums or these plans for people on Medicaid, because we increased the Medicaid rolls so much. What would you say to them?
Well, first, I think there's a lot of work to do yet in health care for small business. That's a top priority for me. And that's what we should be focused on, is how do we make it more affordable and available, particularly for our small businesses that are creating the majority of new jobs. I think when it comes to the question of overall health care system, everybody with insurance actually pays for somebody who goes into the emergency room instead of seeing a doctor and gets treatment they could have gotten more cheaply at a doctor's office. And then everybody with insurance already sees their rates go up. Under health reform, there were some ways in which dollars were raised by asking wealthy individuals pay a little bit more into Medicare or insurance companies who are getting a lot more new customers to contribute a little bit more to coverage. So it really was done in, I think, a better way than going back to the old system where people with insurance just see their rates go up and up to cover people that don't have insurance.
Let me switch topics. Confirmation hearings are being held for President-elect Trump's cabinet picks. You've already said you will not vote for Michigan Republican Betsy DeVos's confirmation as Education Secretary. Why not?
Well, from my perspective, this is all about what's best for Michigan children, Michigan families. It's certainly not personal, but we have very, very different views about how to provide quality education. And what I've seen in Michigan as the outgrowth of the things she's advocated for are actually weaker public schools, lack of accountability for taxpayer money with charters and other alternatives. I just disagree with the idea of a private sector winners and losers model for public education where we can't afford losers. We need every child to be a winner so that we're all winners and the economy is a winner and our society is a winner. And that means making sure we have quality public schools in every neighborhood as well as choice, certainly, for children and parents. But we can't afford to have losers in this process. And I believe the policies that she's worked on create that situation.
How likely is it that Betsy DeVos will be confirmed despite your concerns?
Well, the Republicans certainly have the votes to do that, and so she may very well be confirmed.
I want to ask you, what are your plans on Inauguration Day?
Well, I'll be at the inauguration. I'm always there. I always joke that members of Congress get the best seats because we are up on the dais there with the president and the cabinet and so on. So I will be there. I think this is an important part of the peaceful transfer of power, which makes our country strong, and we need to respect that process.
And you've got some work in the Senate that afternoon, right?
We will be going into session and possibly with some confirmation votes.
Debbie Stabenow is Michigan U.S. Senator. Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The Swiss corporation, Nestle, wants to increase how much water it takes from a well in Everett, Michigan. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality used something called the Water Withdrawal Assessment Tool. It's a computer modeling program, and it determined the increase from 250 gallons of water a minute to pumping out 400 gallons a minute from one well might have a negative impact on nearby streams and rivers. It gave the plan to pump more water the lowest grade possible. MDEQ officials overruled the computer's assessment, calling it too conservative. Public hearings are to be held, and so far 14,000 people have submitted comments, and almost all of them have been opposed to the increase in water extraction. Joining us now is the city manager of Everett, Zach Zakas. I understand Nestle buys some of its water for the Ice Mountain Bottling Plant from the Everett distribution system. How important is that revenue for the city of Everett?
How important?
Yeah.
It's extremely important to us. We basically, they are our water customer like all of our residents are. And a reduction in that revenue would hurt our water and sewer side. So we depend on them as a customer.
I understand you had another large customer in the city, but it made some conservation efforts and reduced its use of water. How did that affect the city of Everett?
Drastically. For example, you take, they were purchasing 500 million gallons a year to basically, they were just purchasing the water to cool down their robotics, and then they were shooting it back out in a coolant pond. So they went from almost 500 million gallons a year to about 115.
How many of these wells does Everett own, and how many does Nestle own or operate?
Nestle doesn't own any of the wells in our city. Basically, what we do is we set aside wells 7 and 13A, and they're designated to Nestle, but the city still owns them. They're type 2 wells, and basically they're spring water wells, but the city still owns those wells. But they maintain them maintenance-wise.
So it operates them?
They operate them. They maintain them. They keep the maintenance up on them and things like that. So basically, they pay the same as the residential customer, $3.50 per 1,000 gallons they pump out of those wells to the city of Everett.
So that's a major income source for you. It's not just like you're splitting the wells. They actually pay the same rate as residents do then.
That's correct.
There was or is concern about a contaminant called perchlorate. How did that get into the water?
Oh, my gosh. Historically, we would have never known about it. But, you know, Nestle has to test and sample for things that, because they do sell to the public, things that we are not required to test through the state of Michigan and the DEQ. So for the last 50 years, I'm going to say 40 or 50 years, we have been having these beautiful fireworks every year. And basically what happened is that what we figured out was causing the perchlorate in our well field was the explosive shooting off the fireworks. The fallout would land in our well field, and the perchlorate's really water soluble. And once it hit, rain got on it or whatever, basically it would wash off the chemicals and it would go into our groundwater.
What kind of amounts are we talking about?
Well, it varies because we've been diligent at trying to, it varies because we have like six wells in that area. So for example, let's use well three in our wellhead protection area. There were some testing that was like at 15 parts per billion. Now, the only two states in the United States that regulate it is Massachusetts and California. And Massachusetts only requires 2 parts per billion, and California is at 6 parts per billion.
Although it is one of the chemicals that the EPA is considering making some kind of limits on, but you're right, that's true.
That is true, but we've been waiting for several years for them to make a decision, and they still haven't made a decision or told us what the requirement's going to be, nor has the state of Michigan.
So you have an idea of what the levels are, but you have no idea whether that's below what might be regulated or above?
Lester, it was brought to our attention in early January, April 2015. Nestle brought it to our attention, and the reason they brought it to our attention because we do designate 2 wells to them. And for example, when you pump spring water, you have to have non-detectable perchlorate anywhere. So basically, they're not even pumping out of one of our wells right now because there were really, really small signs of perchlorate being there, so they shut their well down.
What's being done to remediate that in the meantime?
Well, we received all these NEPSI permits, the National Pollution Discharge Permits. You're familiar with those, correct?
Right.
So basically what they did is the state of Michigan, DEQ, we went through the permitting process, and they're authorizing us to basically we're running our wells, one to waste, and then 2 other wells are being pumped, and it's shooting in one of our creeks up here, Twin Creek. And since we started doing this, and for the last year and a half, we're going to be a template for other communities if the EPA or the state of Michigan start regulating perchlorate on how we have remediated or basically removed it from our well field.
So basically you're just pumping it out at this point.
That's correct. It's going in the creek. It ends up going down in the river, and it just flows, and then just basically we're removing it from our well field, yes.
I assume you're shooting off your fireworks somewhere else now.
That's correct. A year and a half ago, the council made a decision, and now we're shooting them off southwest of where our well fields are, and it's out on our airport. And it's all concrete and asphalt. So, and then we started all these different programs that once the fireworks are shot off, the following day we're out there with garbage bags and picking up any fallout there is or anything like that.
Let's go back to this increase in pumping that Nestle wants to do. As I mentioned at the top of the interview, the MDEQ used this water withdrawal assessment tool, and it said it might have a negative impact on nearby streams and rivers. But the MDEQ officials overruled that model's assessment. Why do you think that was done?
They overruled, stating it wouldn't have a negative impact?
they overruled the model, which said there would be a negative impact.
I have no idea, because the Nestle Ice Mountain has been studying that piece of property for the last, and they have for the last 16 years. It doesn't make sense to me, and that's my opinion personally. So,
as I mentioned, a lot of Michigan residents oppose allowing Nestle to extract more water. They don't like the idea of the state basically giving away water that gets bottled and sold. What would you tell?
Wait a minute. What about Flint? They're enjoying that bottled water. They need that bottled water.
Well, it's ironic that you bring that up, because they're also paying for contaminated water, while Nestle basically gets good water for free.
Well, that's an issue that happened a few years ago, and they're correcting that down there in Flint. But what really concerns me or upsets me is they pick on Nestle. They don't go after Dasani or Aquafina or Coca-Cola or Budweiser. They use way more water than Nestle Ice Mountain possibly could use.
Well, they're also using it from the Great Lakes, and it's permitted.
Well, that's correct. And there's nothing. That's 150-gallon increase is a drop in a bucket. Perspective is DEQ allows Crystal Mountain Ski Resort to pump 6,000 gallons per minute to make snow. That's perspective.
So you're telling the people who are concerned about Nestle pumping water from the state of Michigan that it's fair, because a lot of companies do it.
Well, I just think that they singled out Nestle Ice Mountain for a small increase, and it doesn't make sense to me. When they allow all these other permits, and 14,000 of these people don't live in our surrounding area.
It's still a state resource, though. It doesn't.
Well, I understand it's a state resource, but up here we have we are blessed in Osceola County, Mecosta County. We have lots and lots of water up here. And to take Arlene Vincent's quote from Nestle, who is our manager in this area, there's approximately 250 billion gallons of groundwater in our area. It would take 1,100 years to use it up or dry it up.
So what do you want to tell the people who are opposed to it who don't live in your area?
Well, it has no effect on them. And it won't. And the DEQ and the state of Michigan, and with all their rules and regulations, they will never, ever let this go where it becomes a negative impact just because of all the reporting that has to be done. I'm passionate about it because I believe in economic development. Nestle provides a lot of jobs for our people in this area. We're not one of these areas that have a lot of industry. And they've been a really good paying customer to the city of Everett.
How many jobs is that?
Well, in our local area, approximately in Osceola County, and there's I could say 6 or 7 people live in our small community. There's probably 38, but then they also draw from Mecosta County and the lake and the surrounding area. And they employ a lot of people, and they're thinking of an expansion, adding 38 more jobs. So, look at it economic development-wise. If they're not pumping it, there's other bottling companies that will pump it. So it doesn't make sense. And I'd rather buy a bottle of water than a Coca-Cola. There's no sugar in it.
Zach Zaketz is the city manager of Everett, Michigan, where Nestle bottles its Ice Mountain brand of water. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Lester.
Hey, it's Friday the 13th. Be careful out there. No walking under ladders, crossing the path of a black cat. You can follow us on Twitter. That's safe. At Stateside Radio. You can find me at Michigan Watch. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who never shares the good coffee with us. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Cass Adair, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a nice weekend.